take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the continent to bring you the truth about cannabis and marijuana law reform.
I smoke pot and I like it a lot.
The Rough Melville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation. Now, here's your host, Radical Russ Melville.
Well, on the earth.
All right, well, hello again. As the slide says, my name is Russ Belleville. I'm the executive director of Portland Normal. And all day today, you've heard people with far more legislative lobbying expertise than myself tell you how to lobby federal legislators, state legislators, and political heavyweights. And that's not what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the water cooler wars, lobbying your coworker, lobbying your uncle, your aunt, the people who we're trying to fight to win their hearts and minds. And these days, it's not as hard. We've got some states that have legalized. We can point to a Colorado or Washington and say, hey, look, Denver still exists. It hasn't burst into flames. The sky didn't fall. Everything's okay. So it's a lot easier. I mean, when I started getting into this, describing legalization was an exercise in creative fiction. We could imagine what legalization would be like. We could predict what might happen, but we didn't really know. In fact, there's some things that kind of surprised us. I know when the figures from Colorado came in and they found like 40% of their market is edibles, nobody saw that coming. We didn't see that coming. But in hindsight, it kind of makes sense. You don't give people a place to smoke a joint. They don't have a vapor lounge. They don't have nowhere to use flour. Well, I'll try a cookie and end up in a fetal position in my hotel room, right? We'd have never had that Maureen Dowd story if there had been a vapor lounge in Denver, let me tell you. So I want to talk about, you know, lobbying our friends and our family and just kind of social stuff. And keep in mind a very important caveat. Some of the stuff I'll put up here for talking in social situations one-on-one would be disastrous talking to a lawmaker for reasons that people have explained before. But one of the keys to doing this lobbying is to understand the power of your audience and the power of your own personal story in talking to people on a one-to-one basis. You know, when we're normal activists talking to a legislature, we've got a professional role and they've got a professional role and our roles kind of dictate how we interact. But on a social level, the rules are different. The rules are different. We can be more contradictory. We can be more in your face. We can be a little more controversial, if you will. So to get the idea of how you're going to approach the person you're talking to, it's very important to understand where you're coming from. You know, you are the deliverer of this message. What makes you passionate about this particular issue? And like I said, I've been doing this for 10 years. I worked 4 years for Normal. I talked to a whole bunch of activists, helped mentor a bunch of Normal chapters. And I found in general, we come down to about three types. We got first people who got sick or injured. They have a medical need. And they found cannabis works for their medical need. And then they got really pissed off about it because they'd been trying all these pharmaceuticals that stopped up their bowels and, you know, made it tough to go to sleep or whatever the side effect might have been. And they're angry that they'd been lied to about marijuana and how it could be a medicine for them, right? So that's a strong motivator for you as a speaker. And so use that. When you're talking to someone face-to-face, if you've got that story, you've got that medical need, use that in your discussions with people, because I was talking to someone yesterday who said no one can discount a personal story. No one can argue against your personal story. That was you, that's right. No one can argue against your personal story. That's very wise. The second class of us would be the people who got busted. I've been busted. I'm a criminal in the state of Utah. I guess I'll just have to never go to Utah again. Darn it. But anyway, if you've been busted for marijuana, you know what it feels like to lose your freedom, to have the cops searching through all your stuff on the side of the road while you sit in handcuffs in the dirt on the side of the freeway and everybody's driving by looking at you. You're sitting in that plexiglass and concrete walled room wondering how long is this going to take before I get bailed out. You've had to worry about, you know, I didn't have to worry because I'm my own boss, but you might have to worry about your boss finding out or your family finding out what that will do to you. And it made you mad, made you angry that you got treated this way. You lost your liberty over something like this. So use that. Use that experience when you're talking to people. And the third type that gets into this are the people who who've lost something, either a missed a job opportunity, a scholarship, somehow a relationship fell apart, or just felt the loss of their civil liberty on an intellectual level and decided to get involved in this movement. So find out what motivates you personally and then build your story from there. You know, I'm going to tell you some stories of my own. They work for me because of my background. They might not work for you, but find what your truth is and work with that as your starting point. And I put this last point on there about, you know, what could I say to change your mind? Is there anything I could possibly tell you to make you not want to legalize marijuana? I doubt it. So consider your opponent might have that, or the person you're talking to might have that same point of view to not want to legalize marijuana. It's important in some of these discussions to recognize where to pick your battles. Some people are just incontrovertible. You're not going to convert them in any possible way. So recognizing your own background can help you be more cognizant of why they're not responding to your obviously flawless logic and perfect reasoning, right? Well, they have the same kind of personal attachments to this as well. All right, so part of this discussion is about framing. And framing is a neuro-linguistic concept that has to do with the virtual kind of conceptual worlds in which we form our morals, our ethics, our sense of identity, our individuality. And what framing is about the concepts and contexts and has something to do with what we're talking about, but not literally. For example, elephant. Elephant, it's a noun, right? An elephant, it's a creature. But when I say elephant, what things pop into your head? Anyone? Dumbo. Huge. Republicans. Okay. Circus. There's one, right? But those are the frames of elephant, right? Elephant itself does not say circus. Elephant itself does not say big. Elephant itself says pachyderm. Elephant is just a pachyderm, but we attach all sorts of other things. Sometimes people, when I say that, they'll say memory. An elephant never forgets, right? So just the sight of an elephant can trigger in your subconscious the ideas of memory, faithfulness, strength, solid, circus, fun, all sorts of things. So when we're talking to people and using some of our terminology, sometimes that activates frames for them. When we say medical marijuana, we think of the cancer patient we know who got amazing relief from this botanical cannabis. But when they hear medical marijuana, maybe they think 20-year-olds in a line at the Cypress Hill concert getting a note from a doctor in a tent so they can enjoy the rap show. So their frame, if their frame's not the same as your frame, you can say all the medical marijuana good stuff you want. They're not hearing it. You have to know where they're coming from. The other thing about framing is that you cannot negate a frame without activating that frame. And to give you an idea about that, please do not think of a hippopotamus. What'd you just think of? Hippopotamus. You just, in your head, you saw that big, big old head on a hippopotamus. You saw the big old body. You saw that jaw opening wide. Even though I told you not to think about it, it was the first thing you thought about. Sometimes we make our arguments, we make them and trying to negate certain things. Like if our opponents will say, well, marijuana makes you lazy. And we say, well, marijuana does not make you lazy. They just thought of lazy. And you just put the word marijuana with it. Subconsciously, you just boosted their own preconceived notion about what marijuana is by trying to oppose it. Instead of saying marijuana doesn't make you lazy, you say, no, I know many productive marijuana users. I didn't bring up lazy. I didn't activate their frame. I went with my own frame, a contrary frame that forces them to reevaluate what marijuana actually is. And then the contexts, we all have different contexts. We belong to different political parties, different ideologies, conservative, liberal, different religions, different jobs, different places in the country, different sexual orientations and sexual cultures, and all sorts of things that differentiate all of us, and that can also affect the frames. And it's important to understand that people's contexts are intensely personal and rarely have anything to do with thought-out reasons. Like, for example, how many people in here are, oh, I don't know, Democrats? Some people are Democrats. Some people are Republicans. Was there a day when you sat down and went, all right, well, let's see. Democrats and Republicans. They think this and this. I like that and that. They think this and this. I don't like that. I'll be a Democrat. No, for a lot of us, our family was Democrats, and so we became Democrats. Or we lived in a place that was majority Democrat, and so we became Democrats, right? Sometimes there's some thought in it. Sometimes people are making some conscious choices. But by and large, people are Quakers because they were raised in a Quaker family. They are mine workers because their dad worked in the mine, right? So our context can also be shaped not by the concepts we're thinking about or the actual tenets of those groups, but just from the fact that we grew up in that, or it's who we identify with. People think of themselves as a Democrat or as a Quaker, depending, it doesn't necessarily depend on them agreeing line for line with everything those groups believe. So know your audience's frame, know your frame, so that when you are having these debates, you're talking in their world. We can talk with them and we can achieve real communication. So the framing thing always brings me up to this one, because I get this sometimes of people that will say, shouldn't say marijuana. Marijuana is a racist word. It's racist and it's derogatory. It's racist. It's terrible. Okay, and they say, you should say cannabis. Cannabis is accurate. Cannabis is scientific. And I've gone back and forth on this, because on the one hand, marijuana does have a pretty powerful frame. For a lot of people, it evokes Cheech and Chong, liberalism, burning the draft cards, Vietnam War, Reefer Madness, hippies, Harold and Kumar, munchies. I mean, there's a million things marijuana conjures. But cannabis, on the other hand, is kind of an empty frame in America. Not so much in Canada, the UK, Australia. They have a pretty good frame around cannabis, but America, it's not really that well known. Well, the first thing I would say is that don't be too afraid of saying the word marijuana, because marijuana is, first of all, not a racist term. It was a term used by racists for racist purposes, but it doesn't make the term itself racist. Marijuana is a slang term that means the dried flowers of the cannabis plant prepared for smoking. Another Mexican term for that was sensimilla. Nothing racist about sensimilla. There's nothing racist about marijuana. And then cannabis, when some say, I always say cannabis. I consume cannabis. Well, cannabis is the whole plant. I no more smoke cannabis than I eat cow or drink orange. I drink orange juice and I eat steak, a very particular part of a cow or a very particular part of an orange. Cannabis is just the whole plant. It's the root ball, it's the stalk, it's the seeds, it's the leaves, it's the flowers. So it's not always the most accurate term. Now, I have made a change lately. I like, because I've been using the vapor pens, because I have access to these now. Love the vapor pens. I'll say I consume cannabinoids. There's an accurate term, because I'm getting cannabinoids from this. So the other thing I worry about the cannabis term is something in framing we call fig leafing. Fig leafing is when you're ashamed of something, you want to cover it up. Sometimes to the audience, if they've already got a frame that's negative around marijuana, when you start saying, oh, well, we don't say marijuana, we say cannabis, they think, ah, trying to hide something. Ah, he's trying to be sneaky, trying to be clever, he's not a janitor, he's a custodial engineer, right? They get that kind of feeling in their head. So it depends. I don't give a hard and fast answer on this anymore. Some people, if they're more intellectual, scientific based, I might say cannabis to them. Others who are, you know, more blue collar, working class, I'll say marijuana, because that's the word they're used to and that's what they're gonna understand. All right, so our frames to date. Some of the things that we framed. One of the most successful frames we had is medical marijuana. Throughout the 80s and 90s, we kind of got stuck in reform, wasn't going anywhere, so we shifted the frame. Kind of borrowed a page from the conservatives. Conservatism wasn't doing so well, so they started calling it compassionate conservatism. And we kind of had the same sort of framing idea. Let's go with medical marijuana. And the idea being, people will understand that there's a medicine to it. Some sick people will start using it. The sky won't fall, and then we can move forward with more reforms. The problem with medical marijuana is that it kind of underscores one of our opponents' planks, and that is, someone else has the right to decide what you do with your body, and you better have a good enough reason. And I don't subscribe to that. I don't think anybody has any. I mean, imagine walking through the forest with a friend and you see a plant and you say, I'd like to try that plant. Your friend says, no, you may not try that plant. Well, why not? I said you cannot try that plant. Well, is it going to hurt me? I don't know, but you can't have it. Right, how you'd think your friend was a jerk. Well, that's what our country has done to us with marijuana. The other thing that medical marijuana does, it kind of implies that non-medical use is either abuse or irrelevant. And the difference is the one bumper sticker saying we're patients, not criminals. Okay, I'm not a patient, so... Well, I'm not a criminal either. I'm an outlaw. But that's the one that says, if you're not a patient, then you're abusing it. And it kind of underscores one of their frames. If you don't have a good reason, then you're just a no-good, low-down, dirty doper. Or it's irrelevant. That's when the people, they say, all use is medical. Well, if all use is medical, then why have a distinction? If all the kids in the class are special, nobody's special, right? It's same kind of idea. Now, I will admit that cannabis and cannabinoids being used are beneficial to people that use them, whether or not they realize they are getting that benefit. But we got to be careful by saying all use is medical, because when we do that, we open ourselves up to the idea that anything that helps you feel good is medical. And by that definition, masturbation, a shot of whiskey, and honey are medical. And the other thing, and this is that whole Box Canyon idea that I've been lecturing on the Box Canyon since 2010. It's this idea that medical marijuana, by creating that distinction, automatically forces you into a canyon where the medical definition has to get stricter and stricter and stricter to make sure we're keeping the no good dirty dopers out, right? So up through 2010, in fact, when we say we have 23 medical marijuana states, I don't agree. I think we have 13 medical grow states. We have 9 medical extract states, and then we have, 13 medical grow states, 9 medical access states, and 2 medical cannabinoid states. And that is, up through 2010, every medical marijuana state allowed patients to grow their own marijuana. Maybe it's only 2 plants like Vermont. Maybe it's 24 plants like Oregon, but every patient could grow their own marijuana. Starting with Arizona in 2010, if you lived within 25 miles of a dispensary, you couldn't grow your own marijuana. To date, there are so many dispensaries in Arizona that 97.2% of the population lives within 25 miles of them. So effectively, nobody can grow their own medical marijuana, with a very few rural exceptions. Massachusetts followed, had a similar thing. If you're too close to a dispensary, you gotta buy it, you can't grow it, unless you have a hardship exemption. Maybe we'll make a couple of exceptions. And then the rest of the East Coast, no plants. You're not getting any plants. You come to my store and buy plants, but you cannot grow your own. And the last 2 states, New York and Minnesota, you can't even have plants. You can only have things extracted from plants, like tinctures and oils and edibles and salves. You can't have a smokable bud. So to me, I think medical marijuana just keeps getting narrower and narrower, because they constantly have to find a way to keep the people from gaming the system, from getting into the system. Not to blame the people gaming the system, because I'm one of them. You can't blame someone for finding any loophole they can to keep their ass out of jail. It's not their fault, it's the law's fault. All right, another frame we've used, regulate marijuana like alcohol, has had a lot of success. It gave people a place to kind of attach, oh, pot's not a drug, it's like alcohol. So in a sense, it was a good frame, but it also had some negatives that came with it. It attached the booze frame to the marijuana frame. And now they're asking, where's the breathalyzer? Alcohol's got a breathalyzer. You said regulate it like alcohol. Oh, well, yeah, but not that part, right? So you have to be careful of what you attach yourself to. It's kind of a trade-off there. And another argument, the religious folks make their argument of cannabis is a sacrament. It's ganja. It's the tree of life. Bless them for having their First Amendment rights. I love that. That's great. Problem is, that turns off mainstream religious people like that. When they say, oh, well, my church, we believe cannabis is a sacrament, and we use it as sacrament, the only other sacrament most people think of is the Catholic communion wine. And that's not a whole bunch of people chugging bottles of wine. It's one little thimbleful, right? So it kind of messes with mainstream religious people's frames and makes them kind of feel like you're mocking them, in a sense. It's a dangerous frame sometimes. And again, that whole sacrament thing, again, re-emphasizes there's got to be a third party deciding if your reason is good enough, right? Oh, you're a believer? Okay, you're fine. Oh, you just like to get high? Off to jail with you. So yeah, that underscores something they like to propose. So let's reframe the debate. It's no longer about marijuana. It's no longer about legalization, how much tax revenue we can make, how much money we'll save, any of that. It's prohibition is the problem. We need to show them that there is an evil right now that they must combat, and it's called prohibition. And that can outweigh any of the good that we might be able to predict from it. Now, it's easier to predict the good now that we have four legal states. But for a particular person's state, they can always make the argument, yeah, but we're not Colorado, we're not Oregon, we're Kentucky, or wherever they're from. So we got to show them how prohibition is hurting Kentucky right now. This is urgent. It must stop now. Because otherwise, we're just saying, well, legalization, it's a great thing. We ought to try it sometime. And they're not going to get around to it. Also, we have to show people how prohibition is personal. I can sit up here all day and rattle off stats of 700,000 arrests and, you know, 7 out of 8 for possession and blah, 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 blah. Means nothing to someone as much as your kid at college can get kicked out and lose a scholarship if he's caught with pot. Oh, my kid, right? Now it's personal to them. Now they've got a reason to care about this. And we have to show that prohibition is ineffective because a lot of people actually think it's working. They actually think that drugs being illegal keeps people from using them, despite all evidence. So we have to show that whatever the evils they imagine from legalization, that what we've got right now is doing nothing to address those evils, right? If you're worried about your kids smoking pot, prohibition's not helping that. Prohibition's exacerbating that. We have to show them how prohibition makes what they fear worse, not what we like better, right? It doesn't make what we want better. It makes what they fear worse. So we're going to do some examples. And again, like I mentioned with my disclaimer, these are examples that work in my world with my framing and where I come from. I'm originally from Idaho, where we have 2 strains. Got some and don't. That's it, 2 strains. Very red state. In fact, I'm from the conservative county in Idaho. That's kind of like the sauna in hell, okay? It's as red can be. So I got this redneck uncle, and we're just going to call him redneck uncle, because why not? And my redneck uncle is a God-fearing, hunting, fishing, NASCAR-watching Republican who hates hippies, welfare queens, and the government. Got the big full beard before the big full beards were popular. So knowing his frame, I'm not going to come at him with cannabis cures cancer, hemp can save the planet, prohibition is racist, and all that. He's not hearing that. He hates hippies. Damn hippies. Damn government. Hippies. Meh. So what I do is something that I call a little bit of conceptual jujitsu. Jujitsu is this martial art that takes your opponent's force and redirects it. Rather, if the guy's coming out to punch me, I don't try to punch him back. I take his punch and I throw him to the ground with it. I use his energy against him. So I use my redneck uncle's energy against him. He hates hippies. And I said, well, God, redneck uncle, that's weird. Because if you hate hippies so much, how come you let him get away with a tax-free food stamp, sleep till noon, weed slinging lifestyle? Because redneck uncle, I know you wake up every morning at 6 in the morning and you go to drive to your work and you work hard and the government takes money out of your paycheck. And with the little bit of money you've got after paying the bills, maybe you can buy yourself a 6-pack about 6-7 at night and relax and watch some TV, watch some NASCAR. Meanwhile, hippie sleeps till noon, gets up, slings a couple bags in the park, pays no taxes on it, hangs out, buys some Cheetos with his food stamps, and watches SpongeBob SquarePants all day. You know what hippie would really hate, redneck uncle? He'd hate it if you legalized pot, because then it would become a business. It'd become a job. He'd have to put on a shirt and tie. He'd have to go to work. He'd have to set an alarm clock. He'd have to pay taxes. He'd have to follow regulations. He'd have to get a license. Hippie don't want that. So, redneck uncle, if you're still against legalizing marijuana, that's cool, because the hippies like you for it. And what I did with that, when I did that, you could have just seen his face, like the little gears in his brain is going, does not compute. Because what happens is, and this happens when people vote too, people are motivated to be a hero. When they want to do something, they do it because they feel they're either performing a good act or preventing an evil act. When people voted for, if they voted for Barack Obama, perhaps they voted for him because they thought of the good things Obama would do, but a whole lot of people voted for him because he wasn't the other guy, right? And vice versa, people might have voted for George W. Bush because he wasn't John Kerry, you know, whatever it might be. A lot of people make their actions based on an evil they're trying to prevent. So prohibition to my uncle, there was nothing evil about it to him. Oh, prohibition locks up hippies? Great. Good. Lock up hippies. So I had to find a way to make prohibition an evil to him. And I did it by saying, hey, prohibition is exacerbating what you hate the most about the hippies. And sure enough, it changed his mind on it. I got to the point in the last family gathering, I got him to actually support decrim. Well, I don't know about pot shops and stuff, but I guess we shouldn't lock people up. Like, yay, I want a heart and mind, yay. Of course, he's a voter in Idaho, so it's not gonna help much, but one at a time. Another example, I get these folks all the time. It's really, this is the thing that kind of freaked me out as we got into legalization, is the fact that I actually found myself in arguments with people who are on my side. That was really weird. And I call these folks the true believers. The true believers oppose legalization because it's not true legalization. What? Only an ounce? Why, that's not true legalization. What? Only 5 plants? Why, that's not true legalization. You know, the people for whom the perfect is the enemy of the good. We know these folks, right? So for them, prohibition is an evil, but it's not as evil as the man or whatever they're imagining is happening when we have corporate legalization. So I had to make legalization a lesser evil than what he was imagining. And I did this by kind of agreeing with him at first. Like, yeah, I want better legalization too. An ounce, that's kind of low, man. I agree with you, but you know what? It's been illegal forever, and we've been growing and selling forever. If it becomes even an ounce legal, it's going to be easier for us to keep growing and selling. It's going to be harder for those cops to bust us. So I kind of took his fear of the man and made it work for me in that, yeah, we're going to stick it to the man by having a little legalization that'll allow us to broaden that legalization a little more. Hard, it's a hard one to sell, but it can be done. Oh, and that's the other thing too. Let me go back one. In rhetoric, they call this the fallacy of authority, which is, and it's a fallacy logically, but rhetorically, it can really work. I use this a lot with I-502. It's like, I don't know about you, but I couldn't vote for the same thing that Kevin Sabet would vote for. I couldn't vote for the same thing that the DEA would vote for. I couldn't imagine putting myself on the same side as the cops and sheriffs who lock us up every day. Oh, if I vote no, I'm with the man. It's a hard one to pull, and I have not always been successful with this one, but I keep trying it. So the idea is he's thinking himself a hero because, unlike us sellouts, he's standing for true legalization. He thinks legalization is a wolf in sheep's clothing, and we can keep tolerating prohibition, you know, until we get true legalization. Of course, the people who have that attitude are usually white guys like me who aren't as likely to get busted either, so... And I redirected the hatred from his hatred of baby steps into hatred of being a sitting duck for the cops. Under prohibition, we're still a sitting duck. At least with an ounce, we have some room to move. Another example, I just had this one in Texas Christian University. I got to debate Ben Court, who's on the board of Project SAM. He's one of these recovering marijuana addicts. Okay, that's fine. Worked for me because my frame is my dad is a recovering drug addict and alcoholic who then went back to college and became a drug and alcohol counselor, so I knew his 12 steps better than he did. And for these people, the addict they had a problem with pot, but it usually escalated to harder drugs, and now sobriety is her identity. I'm a sober person, and sobriety is a good that must be championed. Drugs are evil just for being drugs. Just the fact they are drugs, they're evil. So to give this person something good about legalization to focus on, I used my own frame. I said, look, my dad was an alcoholic, and I thank God it wasn't drugs, because then he'd have been in prison, and he would have been unable to get that rehab that saved his life. How many addicts don't call for help because their use is a crime? How many can't get a bed because some drug court put a pot smoker there instead? How much tax money from pot could go to fund drug treatment and prevention? So I made legalization something that would actually fit her frame a little better. It would give more help for the other addicted people. So I help her with her crusade to help addicted people by showing that legalization, not prohibition, is what's going to help that the best. And a little linguistic trick I did there too is I said smoked pot. I purposely chose the word smoked pot because pot is a frivolous little word. Pot, it's pot, right? There's a little less of a negative tint.
Marijuana.
Pot. Pot's a happier word. And so in a way, I was kind of minimizing pot compared to doing drugs, right? And this is one of those points where, like, the first panel talked about, you know, don't throw anyone under the bus, you know, at the lobbying session. Don't say, oh, we need to get harder on other drugs, not marijuana. But this works great on a one-to-one. This works great on a one-to-one to say, hey, you know, we're just talking about pot smokers here, not people who are doing drugs. And finally, my last example, the parent. Lots of them out there. Now, the parent may or may not have smoked pot, but absolutely doesn't want their kids to smoke pot. And for them, prohibition's a good thing because it provides this risk to smoking pot that they think, mistakenly, will keep their kids from doing it. And it provides them an easy parenting answer. It's illegal. Don't do it. So we need to show that prohibition threatens your kid more. Your kid is in danger right now because of prohibition, and only legalization can help it. My example was, kids don't deal weed to other kids because there's a big profit in it. You don't see high school tequila dealers because liquor stores have that market and there's no profit margin in it. And if your kid or his friends got caught with a little weed, would you rather ground him in his room or have a court ground him to a jail cell while you pay off a lawyer? Show that there's a danger immediate right now they got to fix. So anything that threatens a parent's kid is an evil. Use that. Show how prohibition threatens their kid, how it's an evil. Also, give them the idea that you can plant this seed, that part of why some kids try pot is because it's a forbidden fruit that they can rebel with and look all adult. And once it becomes legal, it just becomes boring old people stuff. It's granny's glaucoma medicine. How boring. And also, we can paint prohibition as intruding courts, cops, and child protective services into the child-parent relationship where they don't belong. And that can get you a lot of votes that way. Okay, final thoughts on framing. Some examples from the four states that have done so that have kind of blown up on us a few times. Taxing marijuana will fix our schools. Well, this is a dangerous one because as marijuana becomes more legal, the price goes down and the tax revenues go down with it if you've taxed it by price. And, you know, that gives our prohibition opponents the opportunity to say, see, they said pot would raise X million dollars and it was far less than that. They're just a bunch of liars, right? So don't give them those opportunities. Something like taxing marijuana will help fund our schools or will add to the economy, not fix it. Let's not oversell it. Legalization will end the black market. Folks, there's a black market in everything. There's black market Cadillacs. There's black market cigarettes. There's black market everything. What we can say is we're going to bring much of the black market above ground as we can. We're going to try to eliminate the factors that make the black market successful. But don't ever promise we're going to eliminate the black market because nothing ever has. I mentioned this on the other panel. Medical marijuana will be unaffected. I'm beginning to believe that can't be. It just can't be. If you're talking about having two separate parallel production, distribution, retail chains for the same fungible product, they can't not affect each other in some way. So those of you in states without medical yet, I'm kind of envious because you get to start from the ground up and maybe put it all together in one encompassing bill. And the other one we like to say is, well, when we legalize pot, cops will have more time to solve real crime. No, cops still have the same 8-hour day. Now, it's not like they go, 8:30 to 8:45, time to bust pot smokers. 8:45, time to go after rapists, right? They don't do it that way. They go after whatever crime they see. If they're not seeing pot smoking crime, they're sitting in the squad car eating Dunkin' Donuts, right? They're not actually going to solve more crime. Now, we can say that legalization is going to redistribute resources. It's going to allow for smarter policing. But let's not say, suddenly all the other crimes are going to be solved because we're not going after potheads, because it's not true. And with any sort of claim like this, when they're proven untrue, The next state that has to try to pass has to deal with that baggage. So be careful. And again, stating the evils of the current prohibition is much more reliable than forecasting the good of what could come from legalization. So that's my presentation. I'm Radical Russ. You can find me as Radical Russ on everything except Instagram and MySpace. I'm also Russ at PortlandNormal.org and all those sites. And by the way, audio from every single panel that we've been doing will be available on my SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/RadicalRush. You'll be able to download it and pass it around any way you like. I'm Radical Russ. Thank you.
Far right here, CEO of 420 Radio, among other things. Normal Zone, Russ Belville. Chair of Washington Normal and the man who taught me that marijuana may be a weed, but it's not effortless to grow, Kevin Oliver. And National Normal's Outreach Director, Kevin Malmalji. So I was hoping you guys would each speak for 5 minutes, and then we'll open up questions between you guys, and then questions from the crowd here. Take it away, Russ.
All right. Dr. Mitch mentioned, my name is Russ Belville. I'm the executive director of the new Portland Normal chapter in Portland, Oregon. Also the head of 420 Radio, which is a 24-hour marijuana legalization talk radio network. You turn it on, someone's talking about weed. And we got shows from green states and from red states, so you get all the perspectives you need to hear. I also, on that network, host a two-hour live daily talk radio program, The Russ Belville Show. First hour is a podcast that you can get on iTunes and all the other podcast aggregators. We also have an app that's available, the 420 Radio app for iPhone or Android. And every Monday, I talk with Dr. Mitch. We discuss cannabis science and latest polls and studies. Every other Thursday, I talk with folks from law enforcement against prohibition. You know, what's the cop's perspective on legalizing drugs? So for the past, 2008, that's 7 years, I've been talking about marijuana every day and reading about it every day. And I feel fortunate to have moved to Oregon in 2005, and this is my 10-year anniversary of doing marijuana law reform. I got involved with Oregon Normal. I met the incomparable Madeline Martinez, who pulled me right into, full speed ahead in marijuana legalization. Yeah. Once you get involved with her, things happen really quick. Worked for National Normal for 4 years, 2008 through 2012, doing Kevin number two's job. We have two Kevins here, so I have to keep track of them. Of course, I'm living in Oregon now, and it's been an interesting journey, because when I first started in reform, we had 13 medical marijuana states, and the Gallup polls were 33% in favor of legalization. Since I got involved, we've legalized 4 states, and the polls are over 50% nationwide. So you're welcome. No, I had very, very little to do with it. It's just a joke. But it's been interesting watching things unfold in Oregon, because Oregon was the first place to decriminalize marijuana back in 1973. And one of the 3 states that were the second round of medical marijuana states back in 1998. So you'd think pretty progressive audience, pretty tolerant, and pretty weed friendly. And to a large extent, that's true. But it's been interesting trying to negotiate getting Measure 91 passed that legalized in 2014, and comparing that to our 2012 effort that failed the same time when Washington and Colorado were passing their legalization. So it's been an interesting way to learn what doesn't work and what does work. And now, of course, the big fight we're having is integrating the new recreational scheme, and what does that mean for medical marijuana, and how does that affect and change things? And I know Kevin Oliver will be telling you a whole bunch about that too as well, because we're up in the Pacific Northwest, where this seems to be the big battle that's going on right now. Most recently, I got involved, formed Portland Normal with Randy Quast back there, who came over from Minnesota, and we decided we would get involved with putting the normal word back out in the Portland area. And I'm just thrilled to be here in Washington, D.C., and being a part of this lobby day. Look forward to answering any questions you might have.
First of all, I'd like to thank Normal for putting this together for all of us, and it's a great opportunity for all of us. I think I've learned a lot just sitting here this afternoon. And I thank Keith and Alan and everybody for showing up. It's just amazing. We got my map up. All right, so my name's Kevin Oliver. I've come from Washington State, the Canada of the United States. And I guess we can get to the map in a minute. I run the state affiliate for Washington Normal. I was elevated to that actually when Russ was the chapter director back in 2004 or 5 or something like that. We have four really active chapters in four of the most populous counties. And when I say really active, what I've found since post-legalization is administration of group meetings and having a large membership is almost a full-time job. And post-legalization, there's an awful lot of other priorities, I would say, that tend to come up in some instances. One way I like to say it is, I've never worked so hard for pot in my life. And you know, going and talking about it, and you'll all have this opportunity once you get past legalization to see what I'm talking about. When you're in the states that aren't legal prior to Washington's legalization, it's really exciting to throw up a normal banner and hand out the literature, and you know, it makes the most sense. It's not full repeal of prohibition, but it's really the most logical and most effective form of legal of policy reform, I think, out there as far as groups that represent policy reform. And having that that booth, whether it's at a family event or a hemp fest, you know, the conglomeration of people that are just so excited to come talk about it. You see the passion. Every one of you has seen the passion. You're here because you're passionate. You know what I'm talking about. Post-legalization, people who you thought were your allies and friends suddenly aren't your allies, and they never were your friends. And it's strange. I think we'll probably all get into that a little bit. Russ is correct. We're wrapping up an extended budgetary session. We have industry groups that have popped up overnight representing, you'll pay them, they'll tell you what you want them to say, and then they'll make an appointment with a legislator who is, of course, obligated to give them 15 minutes of lip service, and they'll ignore people like the ACLU, whose sphere of influence goes far beyond politicking for pot, when they say, we don't want a revenue share with the counties to bribe them to come on board. Anyway, I'm not going to get into the politics that's going on. It's insane moving from pre to post legalization. It was a lot of fun. It's still a lot of fun, but it's an awful lot more work. Plus, I have a tier 3 licensed production and processing facility. I'll be putting 2,000 plants in the ground in a couple of weeks. And so when I say I've never worked so hard for pot in my life, I mean it. It's hard.
Well, thank you guys for sitting through another one of my presentations here, or panel discussions, I should say. I appreciate my panelists here, Russ and Kevin, number one, I guess it is. I think it's interesting to both of their points. There's a lot that happens post-legalization that you don't really expect. Of course, as I referenced earlier, when I was in the trenches for Amendment 64, knocking doors, gathering signatures, making phone calls, you know, there were several other individuals that were right next to me in that fight. Now that legalization has hit, we've now divided. It's a fractured community. We have industry groups, we have consumers, and then we have patients. And then from that, you have, it makes it incredibly difficult for you to have a true, honest discussion about what makes sense from a policy standpoint, right? Because you have patients looking out to make sure that they're not being short-sighted with the new implementation of recreational marijuana. You have industry, again, looking out for access to banking, fair taxation, other issues that don't really pertain to consumers. And so, you know, I'm seeing post-legalization, a lot of people, Alan mentioned this earlier, a lot of people have asked, well, what is Normal going to do now that it's, you know, marijuana is legal in 4 states in the district? Well, in my personal opinion, the work's just started, you know, because we have money from the industry. They're able to effectively penetrate the legislature with their messaging due to the resources that they have. And of course, Patients Alliance, they've been around for a long time in Colorado, and they have deep relationships with lawmakers, and You know, and so the consumers are just kind of, the recreational consumers are just left out there, you know, and that's where I feel Normal is going to make the most impact post-legalization, is making sure that we're showing up to these, you know, stakeholder meetings, making sure that you're participating in, you know, committee meetings with the city council, that you're part of the discussions when it comes to taxation, you're part of the discussions when it comes to limitation of plant counts. So that's kind of where I envision Normal moving forward with the post-legalization efforts.
So the three states, you know, we're not going to count Alaska this time, but Alaska is a little bit different because it doesn't really have a really entrenched medical program. I mean, they've had medical since 98, but dispensaries, caregivers, there's not a whole lot going on there. Colorado, Washington, and Oregon, I think, are very illustrative in this. And I'd point out that of the three of our states, I think Colorado's had the best time of it. And primarily for two reasons. Number one, their medical system was very, very integrated. I mean, very strict regulations and a government agency, the Marijuana Enforcement Division, which was medical Marijuana Enforcement Division before. But they already had a very strict kind of regulatory structure over their medical. And the legalization they passed wasn't that different than the medical, as far as I think if you guys get 2 ounces if you're medical, one if you're, yeah. So right. There wasn't a huge disparity on possession limits, plant limits, and all of that. The one thing that does remain, I'd say, in Colorado is that tax difference, the tax differential. Right. It's a lot cheaper to grow, buy it if you're on the medical side. But Washington and Oregon, it's been difficult because we in the Pacific Northwest have had for about the past, well, Oregon changed theirs in 05. I don't remember when Washington did the 60-day agreement of what 60 days was going to be, but around the mid-2000s. Since then, for about a decade, both Oregon and Washington have had the most generous medical marijuana statewide. California has patches here and there, but statewide, we have the most generous medical marijuana. In both states, 24 ounces of possession, pound and a half, pretty generous. In Oregon, 6 mature plants, 18 immature. In Washington state, they decided 60-day supply was 15 plants. So a lot of plants as well. So we ended up with a situation where over the past decade or so, a very large contingency of patients and the people who care for them and the people who grow for them got used to very large limits and pretty lax oversight. There's grower cards and there's divisions, but not intense oversight. So as we passed recreational legalization, and of course the politics being what they are, you can only have an ounce and we gotta really restrict the home grow, and Washington, no home grow at all. Well, that set up a situation where here you have this really robust, strongly regulated, strictly controlled recreational side, and then free for all over in the medical side. Not quite free for all, but you know, far more plants, far more possession. And that got the legislators concerned, at least in the state of Oregon. They got all freaked out about that idea because, oh no, that's going to lead to diversion. You know, people aren't going to get into the recreational program. They'll just go to the medical program. A little harder to get into the Oregon program than the Washington program, but still easy enough that it concerned them. Another thing that happened in Oregon is some bad timing in the media. We had, just as 91, either before it passed or just after it passed, but it was really close timeline-wise, a story come out in the Oregonian from our marijuana beat reporter. Her name's Noelle Crombie, and she told a story of how the largest medical marijuana garden in the state of Oregon serves 104 patients, and not one of those patients lives in Oregon. Oregon's the only state that doesn't have residency requirement for its medical marijuana. So growers, and this grower in Southern Oregon had stacked up all these out-of-state California cards. With each card, he can grow 6 mature plants. So that's a garden with, it's not a garden, it's a farm with 624 mature marijuana plants in it, right? And that freaked the legislature out. Oh my God, medical's being used for diversion. They keep throwing around this number, 75% of the medical marijuana goes to the black market. Nobody knows where they got that number from, but they keep quoting it for some reason. So politically, what we had happen is Measure 91 said 3 pretty serious things. Number one, medical marijuana shall not be affected in any way. Do not affect medical marijuana. And this was put in because, you know, patients pretty much demanded it. Don't change our medical program. So Measure 91 didn't mention it a bit. Another thing we added in there was that only a vote of the people can ban marijuana licenses. The city council can't, in a 3-2 decision, ban marijuana. It has to go to the ballot. The people have to vote on it. And number three, that only the state can tax marijuana. Your locality, your county can't add its own marijuana tax. Those last two things were copied from our liquor laws. That's exactly what you have to do to ban liquor in Oregon, is have a vote of the people, and only the state can tax liquor. So as this passed, the legislature put together this joint committee. Ha-ha. Tell you, they made that joke so many times. They put together this joint committee, 5 representatives from the House, 5 senators from the Senate. Both the House and Senate in Oregon are democratically controlled. So it was 3-2, you know, like 3 House Democrats, 2 House Republicans, 3 Senate Democrats, 2 Senate Republicans. And for anything to get out of this committee, they had to have a 3-2 vote on both sides. You know, a majority of the House guys, majority of the Senate guys. And they were impaneled. They were called the Measure 91 Joint Implementation Committee. Their whole job was to implement recreational marijuana. So they spent their entire 90 days arguing how to restrict medical. They didn't do a single thing about what our recreational program was going to be. They spent the entire time arguing about how they're going to restrict medical. And they came to agreement on a lot of things. They agreed we're going to cut down the total number of plants that you can have in a residence to 12. No more 6 per patient, 12 total. You're going to cut down the rural plants from however many cards you've got to 48 total. And I know red state friends out here, you're going, 48 plants, awesome. But to some of our, you know, growers who are out there caring for 6 cancer patients, that meant 2 of their patients are going to be out of their 6 plants. So this was having an effect on people. They agreed on a whole bunch of stuff that they wanted to get through, and the committee was ready to pass this bill that severely restricted medical marijuana, except they couldn't agree on one provision, and that was, when we passed our dispensaries in 2013, the localities were allowed to do moratoriums on them, or bans on them, up through May 1st of this year. And so 146 out of 242 Oregon cities did that, and 26 out of 36 Oregon counties did that. So bans on medical marijuana outlets all over the state. Well, as of May 1st, they're no longer allowed to do these bans, and we think that all these places that still have bans are violating the law now, because that, you know, there's your deadline, May 1st. The cities and counties lobbyists want to have the power to ban medical marijuana through a city council vote. They want to do a 3-2 vote, no medical marijuana. Despite the fact the recreational we passed said you need a vote of the people to ban recreational. And as one of the House Democrats pointed out, it shouldn't be easier to ban a medical dispensary than a recreational dispensary. That makes no sense. So it deadlocked because, surprisingly, the Senate Democrats wanted to go along with that let the city councils ban language. 3 House Democrats stood up against that and deadlocked the whole committee. They said, instead, the bans should automatically go to the ballot and the people should decide. So that committee deadlocked. So our Senate president just said, all right, I'm forming a Senate committee with the same 5 senators. They just passed this bill, and now they're sending it to the full Senate for a vote that will allow local bans on medical. And of course, if they get local bans on medical, you know they're going to put through local bans on recreational. And once they've set the precedent that we are local control, they're going to throw in the local taxes too. So as we move forward, the lesson I would say from Oregon, especially for California or any other state that's got medical, like Nevada or Arizona that'll be voting on it, is I'm just going to say it. It's impossible for medical marijuana to not be affected by legalization, because you're going to have 2 parallel systems running together. So the question then becomes, how much can you make them alike, or can you integrate them? And I would say that a mistake we made was not including medical in our legalization. Since we didn't put any language in about medical, we had nothing to protect any of the medical. Had we written some medical in, had we said, okay, the dispensaries will be XYZ and they'll merge in with the recreational, or they'll, whatever we would have put in there at least would have given us something to have defense for medical. As it is, we were told to keep hands off it, and now the legislature's got their hands all over it. So be cognizant of the fact that that's gonna be the, in any state that has medical already, it's going to be a nightmare trying to figure out how to reconcile those two things. And like you said, some of the people you thought were your allies turn out to be very angry at you for supporting legalization.
Kind of like Russ said, and I'll let Kevin talk more about Colorado than I will, but Colorado's model of medical marijuana was highly regulated. It already met the 8 tenets that DOJ ultimately handed down for our legalization schemes to work, our states, rather. And Washington was probably, and I say was because it's been forever changed in this legislative session, Washington's medical marijuana was the most loosely regulated. Your 15 plants as a patient, if you were a provider for someone, you could have 30. If you had two patients living at the place, you could have 45. And like stacking cards, you had people say, well, I guess I'll just start a storefront then, and we'll call it I don't know what they called them, but you know, they're just not outlined in the law. And even California's model allows for some taxation of collective gardens, which Washington's never did. There's absolutely no regulations. And I don't know what the perspective is of Washington State from a lot of you from around the country, but there's a real viable industry out there. It's not like as sophisticated as Colorado's because they had that regulation. Having that regulation allowed Colorado, of course, to flip to recreational right away. And the first year of their legalization, they only allowed those people who had followed the law and become licensed and compliant and medical to get a recreational license. In Washington, like Russ said, we couldn't, given the initiative process, it has to be a single line, like you can only adjust one law at a time. We couldn't approach RCW 6951A, which is the revised code of Washington's medical marijuana law, and 6950, which is our controlled substances law. And as far as coalition building goes, their medical marijuana community, they weren't consulted. They weren't. Law enforcement was consulted. Treatment was consulted. The funders and founders of I-502, our allies at the ACLU, our friend Rick Steves, one of the major funders, they wanted the monies from the taxation of legal marijuana to go to very specific campaigns, very specific allocations in the budget. Since this is a budgetary session in Washington State, we've now found that there's a lot of people who want the money who maybe don't want the pot. And so the logic is, if you're a county that doesn't want marijuana, it's, you know, for the safety of the kids, even though a large portion of the tax allocation dollars of I-502 went to youth prevention and treatment, those same counties are now saying, well, we'll take the money from the kids and we'll let you have a pot shop if you give us the money. But really, as far as medical goes in Washington, it never was regulated and it never was addressed. And that's part of the problem that we're having now, is juxtaposed to a highly regulated, legally regulated system of production and distribution, and adult personal use, there is this Wild West out in Washington, and it's not taxed and it's not regulated. Now it is. Senate Bill 5052 passed.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com. You take a seat, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you
take a scene, you better.